And one point, Corey Glover was doing his second solo CD, and he was doing it through Pledge Music, which I don't even know if that's around anymore. But and on there, you can, you know, you pay $10, you get a signed CD. You pay $100, and you can be listed as a producer. I don't remember the exact prices, but you know, those kinds of things. So I emailed him. I said, "Would you consider other options?" And he's like what?" I said, "Well, what if I got to play bass on it?" So next, didn't even reply. The next day, that was listed, three spots for bass.
That's Jed Klobowski. I'm Jamie Green, and this is Trading Fours. Hey everybody, welcome back to another edition of Trading Fours. I hope you're doing well. I am in a good mood. I've got to see a lot of live music lately, people. In person. Indoors. I know, crazy. But it happened, and it's been great. So last weekend, I got to see my friend Brock Alexander, who is the leader, guitarist, singer of the Old Number Fives. Also a podcast guest from a while ago. Actually, Brock was one of the people I had in person originally before the world shut down. So I got to see him Friday night. Saturday, I played. I did my acoustic duo show with my buddy and singer Matt Furman up north in Liberty. And on Sunday, a recent guest, Angela Ward, invited myself over. She was having a graduation party for her son, Jalen, who's this ridiculous, phenomenal drummer at 18. And they were at the Blue Room, and so not only did I get to see Angela in person, who was, like I said, a recent guest, but I also got to see Amber, Flutie Nastiness in the house. Got to meet her, and I got to see my friend and also a recent podcast guest, Paula Saunders. So what a great weekend, man. So today, hey, you know what? I'm going to be my own sponsor. Screw it. I have a 90s band, as you know, Thunder Jacket. And we are offering a 10% discount off for private parties this summer. And we can do either the full rock show or the MTV Unplugged, a little calmer, a little quieter version. And down on the show notes, there's a link to that where you can, if you're interested, put in the email to me, Trading Fours is the subject line, and 10% off. So there you go. You can sponsor yourself. Screw it. I just did it. Hey, so today we've got, all the way from Connecticut, Jed Klobowski. Jed's an amazing bassist who does a lot of cool things, and he and I have become aware of each other because of Twitter. One of the few times that Twitter's cool, and so I had so much fun talking to Jed. He has a lot of good stories. So let's get started. Here's my conversation with Jed Klobowski. Jed, thanks so much for being on Trading Fours, and I kind of ask everybody this because it's, for musicians especially, it's been a really weird 15 months.
Yeah.
How are you holding up?
I'm doing really well, actually. My wife and I are both teachers, and that stayed open. I mean, we did a lot of online teaching for the first few months and some spurts in between, but luckily, you know, we had our jobs, we had our paychecks, and, you know, it was great. I have twin boys who ended up going to college in the fall. So at the end of their senior year, we ended up, you know, hunkered down together doing games and puzzles and stuff. And it's like we basically gained an extra few months with our sons that, you know, normally they would have been off finishing up their time with their friends. And this way we're all hunkered down in the house together. So in a weird kind of way, it worked out really well for us. We were very lucky.
Yeah.
And a lot of people weren't, so...
No, it's been interesting seeing, you know, and it kind of runs the gamut. Jed, I've got, you know, I've had people on where their entire livelihood was playing live. And obviously that's, you know, then they're teaching lessons and a lot, you know, frantically trying to figure out how to do it online.
Right.
I've had studio guys. They're like, basically my life's the same. I sit in a dark room and record and engineer for, you know, and their life really hasn't changed. So it really runs the gamut.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I actually have a son too, who was a senior last year in high school, and started up. So what a weird, you know, situation for freshmen in college. My son actually is going to my alma mater,
the University of Nebraska, and like pretty much every fun thing I got to do as a freshman in college, he did not get to do, right?
Yeah. Were his classes in person or online? Like, was he in his dorm taking classes?
He was in his dorm. What they did was there actually was a dorm on campus that I think was slated to get, it was old, so they were going to tear it down.
Okay.
But he ended up, they would made it the quarantine dorm because they wanted to keep kids on campus.
Right.
And, you know, when you're 18, it's just a different mindset. So apparently that was the fun dorm. Because, you know, they were either got like a cold.
Right.
Or this like asymptomatic or maybe some sniffles and stuff. So they got 2 weeks in a dorm without any RAs. So it's basically like Thunderdome, right? So he told my wife was like, you know, well, that's great. You made, you know, you didn't ever have to go do the quarantine dorm. He's like, Mom, that's, are you kidding? The quarantine dorm, that's where it was all, like, that's where all fun happened.
That's the place to be.
Yeah. How about your boys?
There, I went to different colleges. One's at WPI, Worcester Polytech. And the other one's at University of New Hampshire.
Okay.
And both schools were pretty locked down. WPI a lot more than UNH. But they were both tested twice a week. And one of my sons had a close call. But other than that, they got through pretty good. They had most of this stuff was online. But they did have some in-person classes. And again, that would wax and wane depending on the positivity rates on campus.
Right.
And yeah, they didn't get to do a lot of the fun stuff, but I think it was a good way for them to ease in. A lot of their friends did not get to go to campus. UConn, Central Connecticut State, a lot of those students stayed home. And from out of here, you know, they just didn't enjoy it. You know, you want that social aspect. So they were pretty lucky considering what could have happened. But
right. And you're in Connecticut, correct?
Yes.
What part of Connecticut?
Middletown, smack dab in the middle.
Why'd they name it Middletown?
It's literally like right on the map. You couldn't hit it any more direct.
Like and, the least imaginative mind right? in Connecticut in 1700s or maybe even the 1600s right. named that town, right?
Yep.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So let's back up a little bit since I'm obviously in Kansas City. Let's let's talk about you a little bit, like your musical background. When did you first think, hey, I want to do this? I love music.
Well, I started playing bass in seventh grade. A bunch of eighth graders came up to me and said, come here, you're playing bass in our band. I was like, okay. So I told my mom I needed to buy a bass. And that's how that all started. And then, you know, I kicked around to all the different bands in my first couple of years in high school. And then by the third year of high school, they're like, okay, so what are you going to do with your life? And I said, geez, I don't know. I hear that you can go to school for music. So I asked my parents and they were very supportive. My mom was working at the law school at the University of Bridgeport.
Okay.
So they were ecstatic when I said, well, I hear they have a good music program and I got to go for free. So, and there I met Brian Torf, who was my private teacher, phenomenal jazz bass player. funny thing, I knew that he had won a Grammy with George Shearing and Mel Torme, and he's been on lots of great stuff. And we'd, you know, tease him. We'd pick up his albums in his office and read the reviews on the back, and you know, just kind of, you know, why aren't you walking around a little more pompous than this? Years later, fast forward, and I'm doing some middle school, what do you call it, like regional band competition type thing, and I was in charge of putting the jazz band together. So I called him and see if he would be the director of the jazz band, which he said yes, and he showed up and he handed me his autobiography that he had just finished, and so I start reading through it, and a couple chapters in, he talks about how he was on tour with Frank Sinatra. Like, I've known him all these years. I'm like, I would have led with that. Hi, I'm Brian Torf. I play with Frank Sinatra. Hi, I'm Brian Torf. I play with Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
So my point is that he was just a phenomenal musician, great guy. And when I was in college, all the professors were like, look, if you want to play bass and open up your opportunities, you need to pick up the upright. So I did. And after that, I'm jumping way ahead, but that's all right. After college, you know, I started teaching, and because I went, I got a music ed degree, but a lot of jazz influence there. And when I in Connecticut, in order to keep your teaching certificate, you have to start your master's degree within 5 years and finish within 10. I felt that I didn't really get as much playing in as I wanted to, since I was so focused on the ed classes. So I searched between New York and Boston, every college I had a music program to see if I could get some sort of performance degree. But working during the day did not work well with many of the schedules, partly the commute and partly just the schedules. So UConn actually had were willing to work with me. So they said, you can, I was showing up late for my orchestra rehearsal. And they said, in exchange, you have to then also play for the opera that we're putting on. I said, okay. So, you know, I just stayed on campus later at night and got a lot of experience that way. Really got my butt kicked. Yeah. So, you know, here I was a jazz player that 1 year on upright, maybe two. And I went and auditioned. I hadn't had a teacher for a year or two. And I went and auditioned for classical upright bass. And they stopped me in the middle of the audition. They're like, who's your teacher? I'm like, I don't have one. And I saw him start scribbling notes down. I'm like, oh, I don't know if that's good or bad. But I got in and really, you know, got a working over. So it was a great experience.
Yeah, like boot camp, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about that. I've had some bass players on. I had Hadrian Farrard on.
Yeah, I listened to that. That was very interesting.
Can you believe it? He said yes? I can't believe he said yes. You can tell he's like, I'm stuck at my parents' house in France. I'll talk to you. I actually saw him. We were in New York. What was it? 2018. Yeah. And I'd always wanted to go to the Blue Note. I'd been to New York a bunch, but it just never worked out time-wise. Right. And this time we had a layover, and I was like, Lee Ritenour was playing. I was like, well, Lee, as a guitar player, like Lee Ritenour, that's, you know, so cool.
Yeah.
And it was him, and it was Hadrian on bass, and Lee's son, Wesley Ritenour, on drums.
All right.
So it was cool. It was just really cool. That little bit of that serendipity where you're not, you don't know what you're going to walk into, and it's like, hey, this is great. And I actually talked to Hadrian a little bit afterwards, and he was super cool.
Yeah.
So it's good. But I guess what I'm trying to get at with the bass, so I have never talked to anybody about the differences between upright and just a standard jazz bass that, you know, plays. So what is the rationale? Why do you pick one over the other? What constitutes when you want to play? You know, I know that's more traditional, the old school jazz, but talk me through, like, what makes one better than the other and in what situation?
Interesting. So I think that a lot like the piano compared to the keyboard in jazz, nowadays there are so many pianos with great, or keyboards with great piano sounds. I think it's when people walk onto a jazz gig carrying a keyboard, you know, they'd like to see the look of the piano, especially like a baby grand or a grand. But I think it's just more accepted now that the technology has come along so far. But I think the same thing applies to the bass, that when people think of jazz, I mean, one of the first things you think of is the upright bass along with the piano and the drums. It's just that look. So a lot of times if I get hired for a jazz gig, I'll let them know, you know, well, I can bring my upright or electric. Do you have a preference? Usually, if it's the people that are hiring that want to see that upright bass. The thing is, now I only have an electric upright bass. I don't have the full body one, but that usually turns some heads too. The technique is quite different, and just that woody tone that you get when with those, you know, the flat strings against that wood has a great sound. And I think that there are a lot of jazz musicians that aren't bass players that want to hear that behind them. But again, technology has come so far that I think that they won't turn their nose up at it as much anymore. I personally have a collection of basses. I used, you know, like a lot of people, I would collect basses over the years. But I've kind of narrowed it down to things that I need for certain jobs. So okay. I'm mostly playing my six-string fretless, Michael Tobias, on most of my jazz gigs. That's one of the recordings I sent you. I have a Sadowski five string that I use for basically all, you know, all purpose kind of, because it's got such a wide range of tones that, you know, I can use it on a rock gig. I could use it on a jazz gig if I have to, you know. And then I have my upright electric NS Design five string. That's, you can get so close to a real upright sound. It's unbelievable. And most of the time you're miking an upright bass anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going through an amplifier, you know, it's got EMG pickups, and you can also, the bridge is also mic'd, so you can get a balance between that depending on how you play. You can use it for bowing and all that kind of stuff too. So I think some of it is personal feel, what you like to do. Because I've spent so much more time on the electric bass, I naturally gravitate towards that, and I definitely have to keep my chops up if I want to use the upright to anywhere close to the same facility I have on the electric.
Yeah, and it almost seems, as an outsider, and you're probably going to be like, dude, you don't know what you're talking about. It's almost kind of more of a percussive kind of thing with the upright.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, especially on a full body wood upright, you know, the attack of your fingers on the string, just it gives that attack on the note, you know, that people are
I think that's why rockabilly guys do an upright, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a big part of rockabilly.
The slap and the, you know.
Yeah, they get crazy.
Yeah, that's great to watch. I don't do slap on the upright. But.
Well, it's Brian Setzer's bassist, that's the Stray Cats bassist, I think.
Right.
Slim Jim, somebody. Slim Jim Phantom, is that it?
That sounds familiar, yeah.
And he stands on the bass as he's playing it. Have you seen this?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, that's just good choreography, if nothing else, right? That's funny. Let's go back to where you're in eighth grade. And so when you're first there, they need a bass player. Who do you listen to? Who like inspired you?
Back then, I remember going to school with my Sony Walkman and telling all my friends, you got to check out these bands. You know, most stuff that I'd take from my brother's room, Aerosmith, Black Sabbath, Iron Maiden, all, you know, great bass players to follow. And Ozzy, I would just sit in my room and with the cassette player, you know, rewind. Listen again, rewind, listen again. And I remember that a lot of one of my friends was a singer in one of our bands, and he's like, oh, a bunch of my friends are jamming over here, you should come over. And they're all older guys, you know. They were in high school when I was in eighth grade. And so my friend introduces me and says, oh, this is that guy I was telling you about. He plays all the Ozzy songs, but he plays the right notes. I guess that's what gets you the gig. So yeah, I was so into learning it note for note, all those, you know, there's some great bass lines on all those albums. So I really did not even touch on jazz until I got into college.
Okay.
And to be completely blunt and honest, I'm surprised I got into music school, because I had very little, I had a couple of private lessons from like mostly guitar teachers at the local guitar store. And then all I did other than that was just, you know, play all the heavy metal and rock. And when I auditioned, I don't even remember what I played. It was some rock thing that I auditioned with, because I went to a private high school. So I had a music teacher. She basically taught chorus. We didn't have much of a band there. And I took a couple of private lessons on music theory when she knew I was going to a music school. She was great, Mrs. Irwin. And but no one, the guidance counselors and everything didn't tell me, well, if you're going to music school, these are the things that you're going to be expected to do, and you need to learn this repertoire and all this other stuff. So I just showed up, and I played, geez, I don't even remember what I played. And I know that it was Chopsy. It was some rock thing with a lot of chops to it. And so the guy was like, oh, that's impressive. And it's similar to my classical experience. He said, so who's your teacher? I'm like, oh, I haven't had one for a couple of years. And so I think that kind of got me in the door. But I definitely had to, you know, when I get to college, I see all these people in the practice rooms practicing for hours a day. And I'm like, what are they doing in there?
Right.
I remember I had my, like I said, I had my tape recorder, but they were practicing what they were supposed to be practicing. So, and that was another, you know, trial by fire. You just get in there and learn. And so it wasn't a huge student body in the music program. It used to be a really tremendous music program, and it's kind of floundered over the years. But there weren't, I'm trying to think, there were one or two other bass players. I know one of them I've seen recently. So there was plenty for me to do, you know. They needed bass players in all the different ensembles, and I just played as much as I could. So learned a lot that way.
So had you just only played by ear, I'm guessing? I mean, that's the way that most rock and roll guys listen, you know.
Yes.
And absolutely. You know, I'm 53, so we just had to listen to the album over and over again, or you'd get it on cassette until you'd wear the cassette, same kind of thing. And then, I mean, and I don't want to get too, you know, my wife sometimes, she's like, I really like your podcast, but you get a little too music nerdy, but we're going to get a little music nerdy.
That's fine.
So much of popular, not all rock and roll, but a lot of popular rock and roll, it's very pattern. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's a 1-4-5. It just means the first, the fourth, and the fifth.
Right.
Or jazz, it's a totally different vocabulary.
Yes.
I mean, there's the 2-5-1, which is the second, the fifth, and the first, which is over, but it's completely different, right?
Yes.
That had to be a little overwhelming at first, no?
Still is. 30 years later, I'm still trying to figure this stuff out. Well, the first time you look at a chord chart, I had one guitar teacher, and bass teacher, who was a guitar player in high school, who one lesson pulled out the real book. I don't know if you're familiar with the fifth edition real book.
Yep.
It looks like a huge Bible.
Hang on a second.
Oh, you got one?
I had to take my headphones off. So I'm a work in progress still.
Yeah.
And my dad was a jazz trumpeter.
Right. I remember.
So this is his.
Yeah.
So when I'm like, I really need to work on sight reading better. So what I'll do, and I will put this in the show so people can see what a real book looks, because it's only audio. I'll just like turn to a page and be like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, 900 miles. I'm going to learn, you know, right. And don't cheat. Don't listen to it ahead of time. Right. So I'm sorry. I interrupt you. But yes, the real book is it's like the Bible for jazz musicians, especially.
Right. Right. And there are a lot of different editions and different versions. And there's, like you said, the legal, because the fifth edition fake book or real book, rather. Supposedly was written in a van outside of Berkeley, and that's why it's in handwriting and all that. But I mean, the first time you look at it, it looks like hieroglyphics. You know, yeah, there's mm-hmm. some notes, but then there's all these chords. You're like, what? How do I make sense out of this? So, I picked up some sight reading in college. Probably not as much as I should have, but I was adamant about wanting to learn, and a lot of things that I had some great teachers, and I don't think that I was always the best student. I just wanted to play. I didn't want to learn what I needed to learn to get to play. Just put me in the room with a bunch of other musicians. That's all I wanted to do. When I got out of college, and I got kicked around a little bit. So I remember my electric bass teacher in college, Dave Anderson, fantastic guy, still in touch with him, great player. He's, what's his name? Art Garfunkel's first bass player in like 13 years, and he's just a great guy. And so he would get me some gigs, like a bunch of my teachers would. And I remember he got me this one wedding gig, and the guy, super nice guy, I showed up and I asked him ahead of time, I was, geez, in my 20s, I think. I said, okay, well, what songs are we going to do? He said, oh, you know, the usual ones. And that blows me away, because I play in lots of different styles. So whenever I talk to somebody, you know, in a country band or in a rock band, so what songs are we going to do? Oh, you know, the usual ones. I'm like, okay, you live in that world. I don't. So I don't know what the usual ones are. Right. So I went on their website and I saw, you know, yeah, it had like literally like 200-300 songs. I'm like, okay, there's no way I'm going to learn these in 2 days. So he says, you read, right? And I thought that I read okay. So I show up on the gig and he has a book like twice as thick as that real book. And at the end of every song, he'd look at me and nod. And I'm like, yeah, I guess. So I'd have like 16 measures left that I better just already have memorized. And he turns to the next song. Oh. And we did all night like that. And I did okay. I'm not going to lie. I did not read well, but I tried to use what I remembered from the songs. I mean, you know, all these syncopated funk rhythms like Earth, Wind, and Fire, and, you know, mm-hmm. September and all these kinds of things. I'm like, whew. So needless to say, I didn't get called back on that gig, but I learned real quick, okay, read. You have to read. And I've gotten a lot of work simply because I can read. So,
yeah, you know, it's so interesting because there's so many different ways we can go with this, but I had Slim Gamble on, who's with Lady A right now. He's a really good guitar player out of Nashville.
Right.
And he had the same kind of thing where he was at USC, and there's all the, you know, California, Southern California. There's, you know, I'm trying to think of all the great jazz guitarists are there. And he was like, I really should have taken it. Kind of like you wanted to jam.
Yeah.
You wanted to have fun.
Right.
But especially if you're going to do session work.
Yeah.
There's an expectation that you're going to walk into that studio. They're going to put something in front of you and you're just, you got to go. And I'm just a schmo that plays, you know, for fun. I have bands and I've played over the years, but man, is there a worse feeling than being up on the stage and not knowing what the hell you're doing? It's like the worst. It's
scary,
like,
as hell.
My gut is hurting right now just thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the only difference is nowadays, I like to put myself in that situation. So here in Connecticut, there's you've been to NAMM, yes?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So they have this thing, the All-Star Jam out there, which I'm sure I'm going to come back to because of some people connected with it. But so I was thinking for years, I'm like, wait, you know, they should have something like that here in Connecticut. So I remembered a couple of years ago looking through and turns out someone already started this guy, Scott Weaver, here in Connecticut. And what they do is they put out a song list and say, okay, tonight's theme or the next month's theme will be, you know, Ozzy Osbourne. And they pick maybe 20 songs that, you know, they want. And you fill out a Google form or whatever and say, I'd like to play bass on this, this, and this. And they ask you, you know, do you want to sing lead vocals? Do you want to sing backup vocals or whatever? And you never rehearse. The only time that song is performed is when you get on stage with these other musicians you've never met before. And I just find it thrilling. I think it's great. And sometimes it's spectacular, and sometimes it's spectacularly disastrous. But most of the time, it's really great. And you get to meet a lot of other musicians. And, you know, it's all rock stuff. So there's a lot of guys, you know, they don't get up there and read anything. They're just playing, you know. And that's great, too. You know, a lot of my students will say, you know, how important is it to read? Or you know, why are we doing this? And I'm like, I love the one, my dad doesn't know how to read. He just plays by ear. I'm like, oh, that's like saying my dad doesn't read. He just talks.
You know? Right.
He doesn't read books. He just talks. But I always explain to him. I mean, both skills are really handy because there are a lot of times. Actually, I have a funny story. I was on tour with a fusion group. This is when I was like 22, and we went on a little short tour in the Midwest, and we were at a jazz club across the street from where the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is.
Okay.
And it wasn't open yet. They were just building it. And the manager just talking it up with the manager afterwards, and we said, well, so, who are some of the people he had in here? So he had Dizzy Gillespie in there, and Dizzy was on tour, and he would hire local musicians. So he'd call ahead to the club and say, I need a bass player, I need a piano player, whatever. So this local bass player got the call, and Dizzy Gillespie sent him a set list. So the guy shed on it. And they're on the bandstand. They just finished the tune. The guy feels great. And Dizzy says to the – I can't remember what song, but Dizzy says to the crowd, the next song is called So-and-So. So the bass player leans forward and says, Mr. Gillespie, that wasn't on the list. Dizzy Gillespie looks at him and goes, one, two. So that's when you need those ears. You know, you can have charts all day long, but if someone calls a tune, you got to be ready, you know, follow along.
That's so funny.
Both very important.
Yeah, and Dizzy is, I mean, I don't know how much people know how much Dizzy was really a school musician that he, you know, he wrote charts. He wrote things, like he knew all that stuff. And, you know, obviously his chops were incomparable, you know, him and Bird, but he actually came to my college.
Oh, really?
This is actually one of these life lessons that I tell people now. And I didn't have hardly any money. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I'll just see him the next time. That was what I thought. And then he died.
Yeah.
So ever since then, I don't do that. Like, if there's somebody in town I wanted to see them, I go. Because you just don't know.
Yep. I feel exactly the same way, you know, because there's so many people I wanted to see over the past 5-10 years that opportunity's gone. It's just gone. So,
yeah. We've lost a ton. So I want to talk to you. You're, you know, since I'm a rock and roll guy, I'm a Gen X, so you're not going to be surprised by this. I'm a huge Living Color fan.
Awesome. Me
how
too.
How did you hook up with these guys? And tell the people, all the people that you play with.
Okay. So Living Color is one of my favorite bands since in college. Their Vivid came out, I think, my junior year in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Time's Up came out, that I don't know why, that one just blew me away even more. I loved it, the first album, but when that one came out, I'm like, all right, I'm 1000% in with these guys. So I saw them at least a dozen times over the years. And then I don't know how long ago, Doug Wimbish, I'd seen Vernon Reed. He gave like a musician's workshop in New York. So I remember taking the train, and I'm just by myself. And I'm like, I'm going to see Vernon Reed. Went to see him at, there used to be a club, Tonic. And, you know, I went there. And the nice thing about small clubs like that is you can hang around and talk to these guys afterwards. And he was always super cordial. And then years later, you know, they broke up and they got back together. And Doug Wimbish is out of Hartford, Bloomfield, I think, originally. And he played very often at this place called Sully's, which is unfortunately no longer around. But he would do his Wim Bash for his birthday. And I went a couple times.
What a great name.
Yeah.
Sorry, but I just like, perfect.
And he carries it around. So he was doing it just for his birthday, but now he'll do some down, I think, New Orleans. And he goes to the island sometimes. And so it's a tiny club. I mean, not much bigger than my basement. And so he's at the bar getting a beer. I'm like, you know, just talked to him for a little while. I'm like, do you give lessons? And he's like, yeah, sure, we could do that. So I went to his place a couple times and just hung out with his 800 basses lining up the wall. And he just gave me a lot of really great advice. And I remember while we were there, he got a new whammy pedal. I think it was the whammy from Dunlop. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, good. He's like, you can play and I can work on the knobs. I'm like, I can't believe this is happening right now. And we just, you know, every time I'd do a show, I'd run into them and, you know, just make sure I said hi. And one point, Corey Glover was doing his second solo CD. And he was doing it through Pledge Music, which I don't even know if that's around anymore. But and on there, you can, you know, you pay $10, you get a signed CD. You pay $100 and you can be listed as a producer. I don't remember the exact prices, but, you know, those kinds of things. So I emailed him. I said, would you consider other options? And he's like what? I said, well, what if I got to play bass on? So next, he didn't even reply. The next day, that was listed, 3 spots for bass. I'm like, I'm coming out. So I basically bought my way into that one.
You bribed Corey Glover.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I was able to, so I was all excited. I'm like, well, how's this going to, this was at least 10, maybe 15 years ago. I'm like, how's this all going to work out? Do I drive to New York City? Am I going to be in the studio? Is he going to watch me play? And his producer of the album emails me and says, okay, here are the tracks. These are MIDI bass lines. Do me a favor and record once with exactly note for note. And it was a pretty simple bass line. He goes, and then do another take where, you know, just do anything you want. And he said, I'll pick and choose what I'm going to put on the album. I was like, oh, okay. So I was right here in this chair in this basement recording. My kids were young at the time, running around upstairs. I'm like, this is rock and roll, huh?
Yeah.
But that's where it's gone. I mean, since then, that's how everyone's recording anything. So that was how I hooked up with Corey, and I would always talk to Doug a little bit. And I was playing with this guitar player out of New York City for a few years, and just super chops prog guy, lots of odd meter and that kind of stuff. And he hired Will Calhoun to play drums on one of his tunes that I was playing bass on. So I wasn't able to be in the studio for that either. He recorded after the fact. But that's how my bass playing was along with him. And then fast forward to when I wanted to do my solo CD. And so I should back up a little bit. So Matt Starr, drummer for Mr. Big and Ace Frehley,
yep.
new band Mindfield, which is pretty awesome. He's out of Connecticut, but was in LA. And I don't know how we ended up as friends on Facebook. But he was doing like a career counseling kind of thing. So I hooked up with him and we were talking and stuff. And after a couple of sessions, he's like, so, you know, what you really need to do is you need to be where these musicians are. I said, well, Doug's in Hartford. Everyone else is all over the globe. How do I do that? You know, I'd have to move to Nashville. I'd have to move to LA. And with a young family, I can't do that right now.
Right.
So he said, why don't you come up with a CD, you know, write some tunes and hire the musicians that you always wanted to play with. Okay, that's a great idea. Jazz musicians do that all the time, you know?
Yep.
As a matter of fact, I'll tell that story later, I guess. So I wrote a couple of tunes, just 2 tunes, and I started reaching out to people, you know, through the internet and all that other kind of stuff. So I'll stay on the Living Color vein right now. So at one point, Vernon Reed followed me on Twitter. I don't even know how or why. Probably saw something with Corey and Doug and me. And so I emailed him and said, you know, I'm doing the CD. Would you play guitar on it? He says, well, of course, I want to hear the track first. And he said, and then he said, yeah, sure. So about a year goes by and I saw him at NAMM. He's like, I'm going to get on it. I said, okay. A couple months go by and I see him. I went to one of his shows in Brooklyn. And he's like, hey, man, he's like, I'm going to get to it. Okay, cool. Then a couple months later, they released their last CD, which is
like, really good.
Yes, it's really great.
Yeah, yeah.
So I saw him at Toad's Place in New Haven, and afterwards I went to the meet and greet. I saw Corey. I'm like, hey, man, remember me? He's like, yeah, I remember you. We talked a little bit. Then I saw next in line was Will Calhoun. And I said, you don't know this, but I said, you know, I played on this thing with, and he's like, with who? So I reminded him. He's like, oh, yeah, yeah. He's like, whatever happened to that? I said, I don't know. It's never been released. As a matter of fact, I got to email that guy and find out what happened to that. And then next in line is Vernon Reed, and he puts his head down and covers his eyes like this. And I said, I get it, man. It's not like you're busy with a new album and going on tour or anything. So then, like a few months later, he sent me the recordings that were just incredible. As a matter of fact, he sent me two alternate solo recordings. So maybe someday I'll remix it with the second solo because it's just incredible. Then I moved down the line to Doug Wimbish, and he's, you know, we've seen each other a lot. He recognized me and everything. And I said, just hit me on the spot. I said, you know what? I've recorded with all the other three guys. I said, you're the only one that I haven't recorded with. I said, would you want to record for one of my songs? And he goes, absolutely. And I wish I remembered exactly the wording. It did have some swears in it. But he said, like, as I'm walking away, he goes, nice and loud, almost like you wanted other people to hear. I so wish I recorded this. He said, you know why? Because you're a, you can't even say it, B-A-M-F bass player.
Like, oh, you can say that. It's the beauty of the internet. Right. I curse on this all the time. You're good.
Okay, cool. He said, you're a badass motherfucking bass player. I was like, wow. I literally left the line and just with my friend, I just stood for a little while. I was like, whoa, that just happened, huh? All right. So that felt great. And then I had to go and write a tune for him to be on.
Right.
So that one, that's the third song on my CD. And he plays bass on it with all these, you know, all these wacky sounds and the just otherworldly sounds, I should say. And I played my six string modulus with through a guitar amp with an octaver to make it sound like a guitar. So all the guitar sounds on that third song is me playing bass. So,
well, that's really cool, man.
That is awesome.
You know, I tell people they're like the smartest rock and roll band out there. Their lyrics and a lot of stuff, you know, we were talking about Vivid and I mean, a lot of the things they're talking about, you know, Cult of Personality, we just went through that again.
Yeah, no kidding.
And Open Letter to a Landlord and all that stuff. It's just, you know, they just always were the smart. I actually saw them. They opened up for the Stones on the Steel Wheels tour.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't really know who they were. You know, they came out in the Day Glow, right? What is this, like 88?
Yeah.
And they just kicked ass for like 90 minutes. So been a fan ever since. So that's very cool.
They have a video of VHS I used to own from that tour. And they talk about how sometimes they were really well received. And then there were other times where the crowd would almost empty like the first 30 rows of the stadium and just ignore them or flip them off and stuff like that. And
it's terrible.
You know, yeah, it was a tough thing to go through, but the Rolling Stones embraced them so much that, you know, that really, really helped them out, I would imagine.
Well, they liked them in Kansas City. I can tell you that.
Awesome. Yeah.
At Arrowhead Stadium. Well, that's really cool. Yeah. And those guys, I know I follow Vernon on Twitter, but, and he always, like, people ask him about music and he's just, he'll answer. He'll give you an answer what he thinks.
Or movies or comic books. The guy's got thoughts.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. So now I have to ask about Kenny Aronoff, like one of the hardest, like as physically hits the drum harder than just about anybody. I mean, he's got a heavy foot and heavy hands.
Yeah.
So let's talk, you know, Kenny Aronoff obviously first came to prominence with John Mellencamp.
Right.
But he's been with the, when Chad went back to the Chili Peppers and Chicken Foot, he did that. Hey, he's played with a bazillion people.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I know
John
that
Fogerty.
Yeah. And he just seems like a cool dude.
Yeah.
And you got him and you got Gilby Clark, and obviously Gilby is known for Guns N' Roses, just a small band that hardly anybody's ever heard of.
Right, yeah.
So is this another thing where you like, did you go hound these guys and go to their shows for a while, or what happened?
They did not take as much work. Gilby Clark took a little bit of prompting, but he was super cordial, super mellow guy, super nice. And I went to see one of his shows, you know, once I had the CD, to give him a copy of the CD in LA at the NAMM show. He was playing at the House of Blues. And, you know, he's off in the corner with a bunch of bodyguards. So I went over and they're holding me back and, you know, I pointed to him and he's like, oh, let him through. You know, he's a super nice guy. And all of these guys, the hardest thing about it is if you try to talk to them in public, like mostly at the NAMM show, they're just surrounded by so many people that want to glom onto them. And you know, you just want to talk business, but you don't want to interrupt them because that's rude. So a lot of it was first finding them on email. I became quite a detective when I was looking for the musicians that I wanted. I actually hunted down Dave Grohl's manager.
Okay.
And at first he was very standoffish and he's like, what do you want? So I explained, I said, well, I'm trying to take a page out of Dave's book and, you know, play with musicians I want to play with. He's like, that's a pretty tall order. I said, well, got to ask, right? He's like, all right. He goes, give me a call in 2 weeks. So we did that for like a couple of months. And each time I talked to him, he was nicer and nicer. And then finally he's like, and this was during the time when they had that fake falling out with each other. You know, they're like, oh yeah, we're going to take a break from each other. And I hate us instead of a hiatus.
Yeah, yeah.
And finally the manager goes, look, you know, they're just finishing up their CD. And I was like, oh, I didn't know that they were. So that fell through. But Kenny, I first, I think on his webpage, you can just email him and, you know, hire him to do drums for you. And we were going back and forth. I remember one time I'm emailing him and he said, so you're ready for me to lay down tracks? And, you know, I explained how I laid out all the files for him and everything. And we went back and forth like a couple times in a minute. And he's like, let me do me a favor. Let me get back to you tomorrow. I'm on stage with John Fogerty right now. I don't know if he was sound checking or in the middle of a concert. I'm like, dude, you didn't have to.
Yeah, one of those in-ear things that he could just hit a button while he's drumming away.
And then I went to just touch base with him at NAMM. And I was standing in line for like half an hour. And he was doing a book signing at the time. And there was one person in front of me ready to go. And he was taking like 10, 15 minutes with everyone. And, you know, they're there for like an hour and a half and then they're gone to another spot. So,
yeah.
So I was just about to step up and one of the Coreys, Feldman, is he the one who, yeah, Corey Feldman, he, at the time he had a rock band with all the musicians were females dressed as angels.
Oh, I remember that. So
he showed up with all these angels and he goes up and takes like another half an hour with Kenny. I'm like, dude, I was next. But and then I saw him backstage. He played at after I did the CD and I hadn't been a year or more before I could hand it to him, and they did the Experience Hendrix tour or and he played with Doug Pinnick, who I almost had sing on my CD, and Joe Satriani. So they did like the last half hour as a trio that was just unbelievable. So I emailed Kenny and he'd given me passes to go backstage, and turns out there are some other friends of his in Connecticut that I knew that were all backstage together, and my wife was with me. And, you know, Kenny's surrounded by all these people. Dave Mustaine walks by because he was on the show too. So my wife doesn't even like Megadeth or anything. She's like, isn't that the guy from Megadeth? I'm like, yeah. She's like, she stops and asks for a picture. So it was a really cool hang. And then I talked to Doug Pinnick for a while. And
yeah. Oh, I love King's X, man.
Oh, they're so great. They're so, so great.
It's like half Beatles and then like, I don't know, maybe half Megadeth. It's like that perfect amalgamation. They make it work.
Yeah. And he, Doug, does a lot of different groups too. He plays with, what's his name? George Lynch.
Yeah.
He's got some like bluesy kind of outfit that he works with, and guy keeps busy.
This is great. And I'm putting in the show notes where you can listen to all this, that Jed has sent me, and, make sure that you give it a link. So I know you're a Twitter guy, cause that's how you and I discovered each other.
Yep.
What else do you, is that it? I know Bandcamp, right? You do Bandcamp.
Bandcamp, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook.
You're a slave to all of it, just like all we are, right?
Yeah, I think I'm going to try and start to narrow things down. I think. I don't know. It's hard to navigate all that.
So are you playing out much yet, or is it still kind of on the back burner?
This past year, I picked up about 4 gigs with my jazz trio, the Ken Cirio Jazz Trio. And we did, most of it was outdoors, and we did one in January, which was indoors, very safe, at the Hartford Public Library. And they live streamed it, and I had my guitar player from my band, formerly known as Death Saddle Syndicate. We're still working on a new name, and he's a great engineer. He mixed my CD, and so he came in and did sound for us there, and it came out so good that we're taking most of that and putting it into a CD. So that's going to be a quartet instead of a trio, because we had a piano guest on that, and I'm trying to get some. I do my solo bass with loops and all that kind of stuff. I'm writing a CD. I still play out with that. And I'm just actually was on today in New Haven. They have the International Festival of Arts and Ideas. So I'm trying to get in on that. Make Music Day is June 21st. I don't know if they have anything out your way, but different towns host these days where it's just like music everywhere. You know, like they try and get it in every storefront, you know, music related or not. So I'm trying. Gonna hook up something with that. With the Ken Cirio Trio, what I wanted to mention earlier was, besides that CD that's almost done of the quartet, Ken is also getting other musicians. There's a guy, Achilles, I can't remember his name, out of Greece, who's just this amazing prog jazz player. And so he's playing on a couple tunes, but just found out yesterday Mike Stern is going to be playing on a couple of the tunes.
Okay.
So that's pretty awesome.
So, you know, Mike Stern, I've followed him. I took a little jazz guitar lessons in college.
Mm-hmm.
And my guitar teacher's like, you need to learn who Mike Stern is, right?
Yeah.
And so he had that Standards CD. Do you remember that in the early 90s?
Yep.
And I had reached out to Lenny, his wife.
Right.
And then she was kind of interested and said, yeah, we should do this. And I said, yeah. And I said, hey, you alone? Because, you know, for people who don't know, Lenny is a very good jazz guitarist herself. Right. It's kind of, and I wanted them, and it wasn't like, oh, I really only want to talk to Mike because it's not, right. You know, I was, but it's like, I thought it was such an interesting dynamic to have not only a married couple that are both professional musicians, but playing the same instrument.
Right.
Because that seems like that's really interesting. And that's all I wanted to talk to him about. Like, I was really interested in that. You know, because you've got people like, you know, Neil Giraldo and Pat Benatar, but, you know, she's the vocals and he's the guitarist. Like, there's been other couples too. And I was like, but when you play the same instrument, like, how does that work?
Yeah.
Do you critique each other's playing and be like, God, Mike, that sounded like crap. Like, what? I mean, you know?
Or get mad if they play something better than you.
Yeah. There's got to be some of that, right? There's got to be some rivalry.
I would imagine.
So then she found, and I won't pester people because it's like, I'm not going to be that guy. It's like, hey, be on my podcast. And so kind of dropped off. But maybe at some point.
Yeah, sure.
But Mike's phenomenal. You know, he played with Miles Davis.
Yes.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. And quite a few other people too. He's a monster.
Oh, he's so good. And he had where he broke like both of his arms. Had you heard that?
No.
So apparently he was trying to catch a cab to go to shows, and kind of like in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, where, you know, John Candy left the thing out that Steve Martin. Well, this was real in New York, and Mike Stern didn't see it and tripped over it, and I think he broke both of his elbows.
Oh my God!
And like had to go through this incredible like rehab that went on for a while. The only way he could hold a pick, because like his nerve endings, it took a long time for it all to refire up.
Wow.
Like had to Velcro the pick to his hand, but I think he's okay now. Like he sounds okay.
Yeah. I haven't heard anything about that since, but wow, that's gotta be scary as hell.
Your whole life, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your whole life. It'd be so scary. So I'm curious, you know, everybody that knows a little bit about bass, outsiders, schmoes like me that are guitar players, you know, you're going to hear, okay, you know, Jocko,
mm-hmm.
You're going to hear, obviously on the rock end, you know, you're going to hear, you know, Geddy Lee, you're going to hear Flea, you're going to hear all those guys. Who are some people, Jed, that I should be listening to that are phenomenal bass players that most people don't know about, but all you bass guys are like, that guy's the bomb. Who are these people? Who should I listen to?
Nowadays, I'm going to have to say mostly, jazz bass players. The people I'm listening to a lot, Yannick Wisdala.
Okay.
Amazing bass player. I think, did he record with Stern too? I think.
And where's he? He sounds like he's Brazilian or something. What is he?
He's, I don't know the origin of his name, but he's British, but he lives in LA. Steve Lawson is another British guy. Super nice guy, and he does a lot of looping, and that he's the reason I started doing my looping and solo stuff. And he's been doing it for a long time, and he has something like 30 or 40 albums on Bandcamp, and he's huge into improv. He's actually doing a PhD on improvisation.
Yeah.
And his albums are, he goes to do a gig, has no music in mind, it's just whatever comes to him on stage, and he records it and releases it as an album. And they're all brilliant. They're amazing. And he does a lot of, there's a thing, Scott's Bass Lessons Online. And sometimes he's a guest on there. And he'll talk about different ideas, whether it's chords or his picking style or looping and, you know, different effects that you can use. And it's all, it's definitely a lesson every time, you know, bring your notebook to that. Tony Gray is phenomenal. He's, I think, upstate New York. Evan Marion, I think he was Alan Holdsworth's last bass player before he passed. He plays with Wayne Krantz sometimes in New York. I think he's playing next month with Wayne Krantz in New York. Out of L.A., Steve Jenkins, phenomenal bass player. He released an album. Vernon Reed plays on that, too. I actually saw him in New York with Vernon Reed. Oh, speaking of which, if you got time for a funny story?
Yeah, I love funny stories.
Okay, so my electric bass teacher from college, my last semester of college, he had a modulus six string. And every once in a while, he'd try and teach me chords. And he's like, oh, that's right, you just have a four string. So as a early graduation present, my parents helped me out with a six string modulus from Brian Guitars, now Sam Ash. And so I wanted it for my senior recital. So I got that a little bit early. And they called the store, called my teacher and said, well, we have someone looking for a six string bass player to go on tour. So he said, well, I can't do it, but maybe my student can. So I ended up getting the gig, cut it a little bit short here. Went to, did about 3 months in Germany, and we were on the bus, and it was a musical. And we were on the bus every day for at least an hour, sometimes 18 hours. And every once in a while, we'd have a stop, you know, 2 days in a city. And we were in Berlin for 2 days, and we went to Quasimodo's jazz club there. And we go down, and Bill Evans, the saxophone player, is on stage with Mark Egan on bass. I was just blown away. So I talked to Mark Egan a little bit there. Fast forward 20 years, and I went to the premiere of the Jocko movie in New York City. Mm-hmm. And I, because of the train schedule, I showed up by myself, and I walk into the lobby. It's me, the guy making popcorn, and I'm so bad with names. Robert Trujillo from Metallica, because he produced the movie. So he's there with his girlfriend, wife, filling out envelopes for guests for their tickets. So yeah, I introduced myself. We took pictures and all that. And then I'm just sitting waiting for more people to show up. And in walks Steve Jenkins, who I just mentioned, Mark Egan, Victor Wooten, and one other bass player. I can't remember right now. And so I went up to Mark Egan. I'm like, all right, I saw you 20 years ago at this club in Berlin at Quasimodo's. And he goes, oh, I remember that. He goes, that woman came up on stage and sang a couple of blues songs. I'm like, that's right, I had forgotten about that. A week after that, I get a call from Ken Serio, the jazz trio, and he's good friends with Mark Egan. He hadn't talked to Mark Egan, but he just called, and he and I had done a disco gig a year earlier. And he said, hey, man, I'm putting together this gig with Mark Egan, and he can't always do it. Would you mind filling in for him? I was like, yeah, I could be Mark Egan's sub, no problem. He said, well, on top of that, I'm also doing a jazz trio. Would you be interested in that? So that was about 4 years ago, and that's how that all started. Just total coincidence that those names ended up together. But mentioning Steve Jenkins brought that story to mind.
No, that's great. No, yeah. You know, I think Jocko's, that documentary was really well done. Mm. And I think Jocko's story is both, you know, how would you put it? I mean, part of it's very inspiring. I mean, this kid from Florida. I mean, you don't think of jazz Florida, right? And he becomes phenomenal, and he's, you know, he does crazy things at first, not now, but back then he pulls all the frets off the bass because what we were talking before, you kind of want that fretless upright sound, but you want it this way.
Right.
And then and I don't mean this glibly. I don't mean this, you know, offhand. He really loses his mind. He has a mental illness. He goes completely, he's homeless right at the end. And then some bouncer who doesn't understand that he's not all right in his head and kills him.
Yeah.
I mean, and he was, what was he, Jed? Like in his 40s when he was young.
If that, I think he was in his 30s, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was young. And, you know, and I think it's really interesting when you have, I think for guitar players in the jazz thing, it's, you know, Wes Montgomery's that guy that everybody talks about.
Right.
And I think for bass, it's Jocko.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the standard. I mean, and if you listen to his playing, the movie definitely helps with his person to understand his personality. I don't know if you ever saw the Jerry Jamat interviews him for the instructional video.
No, I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I mean, it's got great stuff for bass players to learn technique and skill wise. But seeing him in that role, you know, you saw the documentary, I'm assuming, and you remember in the documentary how the first, I don't know, 10 years of his life as a bass player, he would just introduce himself as the greatest bass player in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't lying. He wasn't really even being cocky about it. It was just kind of matter of fact. And it was true. So to deal with that, and then because the music industry didn't continue to raise him up. You know, any progression he made was self-made. You know, when he had his big band and when he went on tour, and he was doing all the work. And I don't think that the record companies helped him much at all. You know, just like most of the time, they're like, you just keep doing what you're doing and we'll just keep breaking
you're just
money.
A commodity, man. You're a money stream to them.
And I think that the strain of that relationship with his record company and just with regular life and not getting the adulation that he clearly deserved, you know, that could affect people. And on top of that, I think he was bipolar. So none of that is a good mix. You know, it's a real tragedy.
No, it's sad. It's very sad. You know, and then I'll let you go because I know we've been almost an hour, but it's, I know when you have fun, you talk music, it's fun. I just, you know, that stuff with Joni Mitchell. I mean, Joni Mitchell, musicians get how good Joni Mitchell is.
Right.
But people, like, they just think, oh, both, you know, Joni Mitchell's both sides now. So, but is it Hijara? How does she pronounce that? That one album.
That's right.
And it's him and it's Pat Metheny on guitar. And it's just mind blowing. And you think about it when that had to come out at the time. I mean, you know, Jaco, he really made bass. It could be the melodic instrument that led. And that really hadn't, I mean, probably in little spurts, but probably not like an entire song.
Right.
And the use of harmonics and really cool things that, you know, it's kind of like with Hendrix, like, you know, Hendrix comes in and guitar's never the same again. Right. Same thing with Jaco with bass. It's just never the same.
Right. And, you know, you had people like Paul McCartney, which obviously he very much admired, but he was like, and I'm sure people would probably take offense to this, but he was basically Paul McCartney on like super steroids. I mean, because Paul McCartney was very melodic in all of his writing and everything. And Jaco heard all that stuff too. It, you know, I think he used to describe it as like, you know, the notes are in the air. You just got to pull them out. I'm like, I wish it was that easy, buddy. But, you know, he was obviously a genius and just
phenomenal. Yeah. Well, and in some ways he never dies, right?
Right.
Yeah. Right.
His son and his nephew are both great bass players.
Are they?
Felix Pastorius. Oh, check him out.
Okay. I'll do it. So I really appreciate the time. It's always so much fun to get to meet people. And, you know, kind of like what you're talking at the beginning with your sons, and you're kind of looking at the bright side with COVID that you got to spend more time with them that you wouldn't have. You know, one of the things is, you know, if I didn't have COVID, I'm not talking to you. Because this whole podcast started like, well, I'm going to talk to Kansas City musicians that I just don't think people are paying and they need to. And then I'm like, well, what am I going to do now? And then it like turns in like, well, the whole world's sitting on their butt, not playing right now. And so I just started, you know, I got Neil Giraldo on. I got Hadrian on. I got, Osnoy on.
You know what? I listened to a few and the last one was that, I can't remember his name, the Scottish guy.
Oh, yeah. David Barr.
Yes. And all the ones I listened to, everyone had accents. I'm like, should I have an accent going on there?
You know, it's so funny with David Barr. He and I now, like, we're like Instagram buddies and like we comment on it. And like, that's what music can do. I mean, this is a guy from Edinburgh, Scotland, who's probably, I don't know, 25, I'm guessing, from looking at his pictures. And I had somebody that recommended me and he was interested. And he had such a great time because, you know, I'm 40% Scottish and have been over there and I love Scotland. And we had a great chat. And now he's going across the country. In fact, he and I had a back and forth about he's in Austin and talking about food down there. And so, how cool. I mean, that's what makes music so much fun. You get to talk to, like you were saying earlier, like, you know, you're not going to get to hang out or talk to Kenny Aronoff or Vernon Reid or Doug or any of those people without that connection.
Exactly.
And
also, you know, I've done a lot of sub work. Like I get called for random stuff all the time. Like I mentioned a couple of years ago, I got called to do a couple of country gigs and I'd never played country or reggae gigs. I'm like, all right, I'll learn it. You know, I'll do the best. And sometimes you work with a musician, they're hired gun as well, and you don't see them for maybe another couple of years. And then you get back on the bandstand with them. I'm like, oh, you're on this gig too. Cool. Good to see you. How you been? And it's just old friends with minutes of time that you spend socializing, but you have that connection of the music. And that's the thing is, you know, you find someone that you like to play with and it's always a pleasure to see him again. And it's just having a conversation through your instruments, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, that's why I called it Trading Force, Jed.
Yeah. It's great. I like the title.
No. Well, it's so cool. I hope to make it to NAMM.
Yeah, me too.
It's one of my like things I always want to do. My favorite NAMM video Have you seen the video where the guy's screwing around with Eddie Van Halen's new gear?
No.
I'll send you the link when I.
All right, please.
It's so funny because you know, and I think most people who play, like, I hate people who noodle.
Yeah.
In public spaces, and I always feel like there's this inverse relation. Like, the better player you are, the least amount, like, the volume is low.
Right.
And the guys that suck decide that they need to turn it up so everybody can hear how bad they are. Right. There's a lot of that.
Yep, absolutely.
And I always tell the guys that work in shops, it's like, do you take like 12 Excedrin a day? How do you, this would drive me up the wall. I hate it. But so this guy's, and he's got somebody filming him. So I'm sure he's like, hey, look how cool I am. I'm going to, and he's playing Eddie's stuff for a while. And he's okay. I mean, he's not terrible.
Right.
I'm not trying to slag him, but he's not great either.
Right.
He's just okay. And all of a sudden he's like playing and he looks up and it's Eddie.
Wow.
And he's like, oh, Mr. Van Halen, like that. And Eddie is like, no, keep playing. Keep playing, And the guy's like, oh, no, it's great guitar. And
yeah.
Just to see his eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like as a guitar player, it's like your worst nightmare if there's somebody like the guy playing his guitar. Anyway, so NAMM is one of those things I've always just like, I just like to go see NAMM for the people watching.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. I was supposed, and have you been to Summer NAMM in mm-hmm. Nashville?
No.
It's about a quarter of the size, but it's still great. And I was, before the pandemic, I was all set to, with my rock band, Death Saddle Syndicate, we were all set to go and play a couple of shows. And I was invited to play at, not the Bass Bash. They had a couple of bass hang. I think it was the Bass Hang, maybe. One of those. And it was at this place, Douglas Corner, that had been around for years. And I'd been to Nashville. Actually, a former student of mine lives in Nashville. So we got to catch up there. And so at the last NAMM, before everything was shut down, I was invited to play at this Bass Bash. I was going to do a little bit of soloing and stuff. And what's his name? Mr. Boonshaft from Aguilar. He's like, oh, I told him about it. And he's like, oh, well, we go out for drinks. You should come on by. I was like, sounds great, before the whole show starts. And then it all got shut down. I was like, I had such a great year and all these gigs. But like I said, I was lucky compared to a lot of people. But hopefully that'll come back around. I know that Douglas Corner is closed for good now, but I'm sure they'll find another spot. But yeah, the NAMM things are great. You run into so many great musicians, and it's the same thing. Sometimes that's the only place you see them.
Right.
Know?
No, I got to do it. I have friends out in LA, so I don't have to pay for a place to stay. So I have no excuses. And it's January, where the weather here sucks.
Right.
Same,
exactly.
Same in Connecticut, right?
Yep.
Well, Jed, I you should come to Kansas City sometime. I mean, if you're the jazz guy too.
Absolutely. I'd love
Here's the town, man.
Absolutely. Ken Ciriotrio is looking at, he's looking at a European tour next year. But I'm sure we can definitely work something up. Once things start opening up again, maybe we'll do a little couple weeks here in the summer or something.
Yeah.
And we'll be looking at Kansas City.
You should, and it's a town that obviously has all the history and everybody knows the history, but I'm telling you, man, there's a bunch of young, really amazing players right now.
Great.
It's really interesting. And it's drawing people national, that's what, Basie was from New Jersey originally, right?
Right, right.
A lot of those guys came here because it was where to play. But, depression, there was no place else. And, Kansas City was a wide open town. If you could imagine it was happening here. And that's why they came here. I mean, the only one that was really from here is Parker. But the rest of the people, they gravitated here. Lester Young, I think, was from Mississippi or somewhere originally. Anyway, there's a lot of great clubs here in town. A lot of great places to play. So, yes, come out sometime.
All right.
And I really appreciate time. Klebowski, yes. How'd I do?
Perfect.
Perfect. Hey, man, it's so nice to talk to you. You have a great night. And
thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. All right, man. Have a good night.
Thanks. You too.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Jed Klebowski, everybody. Jed, thanks so much for being part of Trading Fours. We had a lot of fun. We actually made that a cocktail hour. So if you listen closely, you can listen to my ice and my glass as I had a good scotch, as I do. So thanks so much to Jed. Yes, down in the show notes, you can see how to follow Jed. This is him playing a solo thing, and this is very beautiful. And, people think of the bass only, a lot of people anyway, as a rhythm instrument. But, hey, it can be a lead instrument, as Jed's proving right here. So thanks so much to Jed. Hey, that's going to do it for today's Trading Fours. But next time, we're going back to Kansas City. I've got Deanne. Deanne has come. Not only is she going to be on the podcast, she actually came to my house indoors. My first indoor in-person interview in over 14 months. We had another cocktail hour. We had a great chat. She's got a brand new album coming out called Play Them Cards. And we're going to talk about how COVID really sparked her creative process and also had a very sad and tragic effect on her life personally. So that's next time. Until then, go out and support live music, and we'll talk real soon. Bye-bye. ¶¶